for English majors, 1996, grade 8. Paper 1. Part 1, listening comprehension. In sections A, B, and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Section A, talk. Questions 1 to 5 refer to the talk in this section. At the end of the talk, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now listen to the talk. Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In previous weeks, we talked about different types of pollution, and this week, I want to focus on air pollution, with air pollution caused by the car. It's well known that cars are the main cause of air pollution in cities, which comes up to 60% in some cities, and in others, even as high as 90% of all air pollution caused by the car. Cars contribute a great deal to the air pollution in our cities, and this will get worse as the number of cars increases in the cities. Firstly, I'd like to talk about how cars cause air pollution. How does a car cause air pollution? Well, you are all familiar with the internal combustion engine. There's a mixture of petrol, which explodes, and this explosion helps propel a car forward. Unfortunately, in this process, there are some poisonous chemicals which remain, and these poisonous chemicals mainly come out of the back of the car through the exhaust. Now, it's not just what comes out of the car exhaust that is dangerous. The brakes also cause pollution. The brakes on cars give off asbestos. And as you know, asbestos is a highly dangerous substance and can kill us. And thirdly, the tires themselves give off small rubber particles, which are not very good for health. We need to find solutions to this problem. I'm going to talk about 4 possible solutions. Firstly, we should try and discourage the use of cars. We could do this by putting higher taxes on petrol, or we could make cars more expensive. We could put the price of cars up. Secondly, we might encourage alternative methods of transport. For example, recently in Shanghai, you built a subway which takes some of the pressure off the roads. Some people would use the subway rather than using cars. In addition, we could improve public transport, make it more comfortable, safer, and more regular so that the people will use public transport rather than cars. Next, we could also use cleaner fuels rather than petrol. For example, we might use natural gas in the future, or we might experiment with battery group in cars. And lastly, we could try mechanical means for reducing the amount of chemicals that are emitted, which come out of cars, which come out of the exhaust pipe. We could fix things called catalytic converters to exhaust pipes. These are a device which are fixed over the exhaust, which controls the carbon monoxide, which reduces the amount of dangerous chemicals that cars give off. Now, it's unlikely that any of these solutions will work on its own. I'm pretty sure that it would take a combination of all 4 of these solutions to solve the problem.
Section B, interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on an interview with an architect. At the end of the interview, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now, listen to the interview. So you're an architect?
Yes.
Do you work for a public or a private organization, or are you self-employed, that is, working on your own?
I'm working for a private design and construction company.
How did you start your career?
I started it with the government.
Oh, did you? What made you decide to work for the government?
Well, it was a matter of chance, really. I saw an advertisement for a vacant position in the newspaper, and I thought, why don't you try it? In fact, I have no preferences where I work, public or private.
And do you still have this idea, or?
More or less, yes. Although I'm now working with a private firm, I worked for the government for about 3 years. It was all right. Of course, there's the bureaucracy that one has to put up with, but that's not bad. If you don't mind bureaucratic wheels turning slowly and things not being as efficient.
And what made you leave the public sector?
Money, mainly. You see, I got married, and my husband doesn't work, and we wanted to start a family right away. So we thought it might be better if I moved to the private sector. This is why it's hard for me to be self-employed, because self-employed work has a disadvantage that there may be a time or a period of time when you are unemployed.
I see. So, did you join this company straight away?
No, I worked in a couple of private firms before I came to this one.
Mm-hmm. Now, what qualifications does one have to become an architect?
Well, you've got to have a degree in architecture. That means, before you apply to study architecture in any university, you have to pass exams, usually 3A levels with good results. Also, you generally have to study sciences at school rather than arts as a basis for the subject to be studied at university level. Although, when you really get down to it, the subject involves some aspects of arts, too. Then you need between 6 and 7 years to work through, by the end of which you usually sit for the final examination.
So you mean, to take up architecture, one has to have a scientific background?
Well, yes, mainly scientific, but it helps if you have some general arts background, too. You know, architecture is not a pure science.
Now, if one wants to take up architecture, one has got to be able to draw. Is that really true?
Well, it is true that the work of an architect involves a lot of drawing, and to be an architect, you must be able to draw. But this doesn't mean that if you can't at present draw, you won't have the opportunity to be an architect, because you can be taught to draw. In fact, drawing in architecture is different from drawing in art. An artist's drawing must be good in the sense that it gives a certain impression in the mind of the viewer. In fact, some famous artists can't draw very well at all, at least not from the technical point of view. On the other hand, architect's drawing must be accurate. So, I said that accuracy of the drawing is what we aim at, what's important.
Now, what qualities do you think make a good architect apart from the accuracy in his drawings?
Well, I'm not sure if I can generalize about that. You see, architecture is a mixture of theory and practice. So I suppose a good architect should be good at both. And an architect's work is good in as much as the construction is built precisely as the theory requires, so that it doesn't collapse or can't be used after a period of time because it's dangerous. I don't mean a well-built construction will last forever, but it's predictable, that is, if the building is constructed in a certain way or with certain materials, we can say how long it will last, provided that there's no other factor.
Such as?
For example, an earthquake or if the ground level sinks, which may destroy it. So that's one part of being a good architect, to design a construction which is attractive and will last a long time.
Right. So that's the theory side. Now what about the practical aspect?
Yes, the practical side concerns, I'd say, the use of the construction you design. If you design a house, the people who live in it later on must be happy as they live in it. A college student shouldn't think to himself, "Oh, I'd rather study in the library. My bedroom is too cold because the ceiling seems to be too high and the window's too big." Or, say, when somebody is cooking in the kitchen, the smell of food shouldn't disturb someone who's still in bed. The bathroom should be situated for everyone's convenience, but while it's being used, the noise shouldn't disturb anyone. So you see, these practical things which give you comfort apart from serving the purpose of the construction, whatever it may be, a school, a hospital, a hotel, and so on.
Section C, News Broadcast. Questions 11 to 12 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the two questions. Now, listen to the news. A man who fired 3 shots into a crowded birthday party, killing 1 man and wounding 2 other people, has been sentenced to 60 years in prison. 36-year-old Mark Eastwood was in court for sentencing today after a jury found him guilty of manslaughter, but not guilty of murder. Mark Eastwood snapped after being kept awake for 4 successive nights by noisy parties yards away from his home. He took a loaded revolver and fired 3 shots through the window of a house in the southwestern part of the city. A 25-year-old man at the party died after being hit in the head. 2 other people were seriously wounded. The court was told that Eastwood had a lengthy criminal record for dishonesty, and he was keeping a gun without a license. Sentencing him to 60 years in prison, Mr. Justice Dawson said, "No one must be allowed to kill innocent people and not to be severely punished."
Questions 13 to 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 45 seconds to answer the 3 questions. Now listen to the news. A 23-day search operation that begins Thursday will include 84 Americans and their Vietnamese counterparts split in 8 teams. The spokesman for the operation said 4 of the teams are currently in the midst of a dry season. The spokesman said Vietnam turned over 67 sets of remains, which the Vietnamese believed to be of Americans last year, the most since it began returning such remains in the early 1980s. Vietnam first allowed American search teams into the country in 1988, and the first consisted of just 3 men. Vietnam has turned over hundreds of sets of remains since the end of the war in 1975. So far, 280 such sets have been positively identified as the remains of missing Americans. The remains are examined by forensic specialists at the U.S. Military Laboratory in Hawaii. The fates of more than 2,200 American servicemen who are missing in Southeast Asia remain unsolved. 1,648 of those are listed as missing in Vietnam or its waters. In an interview with the Associated Press, Major General Thomas Needham, the search operation commander, said he was pleased with the process being made to account for the missing men. He said he and his teams were allowed to go wherever they wished in Vietnam. General Needham said he constantly pushed the Vietnamese to find and hand over more documents about the missing men. General Needham said he didn't believe that the Vietnamese government was holding back remains. However, he said some individuals who had come across remains were holding them back in the hope of being paid for them. The U.S. does not pay for remains. In a related development, the U.S. military announced Wednesday that Admiral Charles Lawson, the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, will visit Vietnam beginning January 16th. Admiral Lawson will visit the American Missing in Action Office in Hanoi, discuss the issue with the Vietnamese officials, and travel south to observe the excavations. Admiral Lawson will become the highest-ranking U.S. military officer to visit Vietnam since the end of the war. Admiral Lawson's visit and extensive search will come at a time when officials in Washington say the question of the U.S. trade embargo against Vietnam is under active review. Ann Butler for VOA News, Bangkok.
Section D, Note-Taking and Gap-Filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening to the lecture, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. Today, I'm going to consider very briefly a problem concerned with the competition for land use. That is, whether crops should be used to produce food or should be used to produce fuel. And in considering this problem, I will look at 3 main areas: the historical background to the problem, the nature of the problems involved in the competition for land use, and some examples. In considering the historical background, we should look at the oil crisis of the 1970s. Due to the rapid trend in increasing oil prices leading to an energy crisis, many countries have looked for alternative energy sources to make them independent of other countries' fossil fuels. Examples of alternative energy sources include such things as solar power, the harnessing of wind and waves, tides, and also the production of biogas. Biogas is methane, which is produced from human and animal waste. A particularly interesting possibility for many developing countries has been the conversion of plant material to alcohol. This is interesting because in many developing countries, there is a large agricultural sector and at the same time a small industrial sector. And thus, the possibility of using the agricultural sector to produce fuel is of interest to those countries. Scientific research is going on in the production of alcohol, for example, from sugar. And there are 2 economic reasons for this. First of all, the world price of sugar has fallen dramatically, or the world price of sugar has fallen in very real terms in the last decade. This has caused the problem for those economies which are dependent on their sugar production, as it gives them an alternative possibility for using their sugar. Secondly, sugar is the most efficient source of alcohol. Therefore, it is relatively economical to make fuel by distilling alcohol from it. In addition to sugar, there are other starchy plants that can be used to make alcohol. For example, in tropical countries, such plants as the cassava plant and sweet potato are good sources from which alcohol can be made. And in non-tropical countries, you have such things as corn and sugar beet. Now, there is a problem arising from the fact that alcohol can be distilled from starch plants, and that is that many poor countries use precisely these starchy plants, or the starch-rich crops, for their food as a staple diet. So in many such countries, there is a conflict, if you like, between the choice whether to produce these crops for fuel or to produce these crops for food and for their use as their staple diet. It is, in fact, an economic problem rather than a technical problem, as the poor farmers will tend to choose that which is more profitable. Indeed, it is an economic problem, not necessarily a technological problem. The technology for the conversion of alcohol from starchy plants has been in existence for over 40 years, and there are two ways of using alcohol as car fuel. One such way is in the form of pure alcohol, and an example of this is in Brazil, in a project called the Pro Alcohol Project. In Brazil, cars are being produced to run on pure alcohol. A second use of alcohol as a car fuel is in a mixture of petrol or gasoline. In a mixture with gasoline, this produces a mixture called gasohol. In Germany, for example, they have an experiment in which there is such a mixture of 85% petrol or 85% gasoline and 15% methanol. So, if technology and the conversion of engines are not a problem, then really it is a question of economics, and there are three main factors which should. Now you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then please complete the 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet. This is the end of listening comprehension.